This is Book Public from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. On this episode, I talk to Maria Reva about her novel, Endling. There are so many things to say about this book that make it different from almost anything I've ever read before. Even though there have been comparisons made between Maria Reva and George Saunders and Maria Reva and Percival Everett and their writing in the absurdist literary tradition. Maybe a little bit of setup would help. Well, there's a snail biologist, Yeva, in Ukraine, who tries to save the country's snail species from the brink of extinction. This is where the book's title comes from. An endling is the last individual of a species or a subspecies. Yeva funds her conservation work by dating Westerners who come to Ukraine on guided romance tours. The idea is that there are docile brides untainted by feminism or modernity in this part of the world. This is a generalization that can be easily refuted. But the characters of Nastya and Solomia take good advantage of it as they embark on a plan to find their mother, a woman who protested the so-called bride tours. And then Russia invades Ukraine. Maria Reva could not go on writing this novel without real life coming into the pages of her work. Maria Reva, in first person, takes over the narrative to address what she experienced and what her loved ones experienced in the war-torn part of the world. We reach another part of the novel that leads somehow back to Yeva and her concerns. The stories merge and mingle. It all makes perfect sense somehow. We learn of the ways that a species can die off and consider the death and destruction of war, and how to survive and make meaning of it all. I spoke to Maria Reva about her novel, Endling. Well, first things first, tell me about Endling.
Well, thank you so much for having me on your podcast. Endling combines a whole bunch of different threads. It's about the outsourcing of romance to different countries. It's about the art of snail conservation and getting rare snails to breed. And this is set against the backdrop of the war in Ukraine.
That says it, but there's more to it. I want to ask you about the snails first. Our character, Yeva, she is a scientist. She works out of her RV, and this is her purpose in life. But where did this idea come from for you? Is this something you were interested in yourself? Because you must be a consummate researcher. The granular details, I feel like I learned so much. Tell me about that element of the novel, because it's so interesting.
Well, I do love snails because I think they're the antidote to our fast-paced modern life. I think if you watch a snail for long enough, it kind of puts you into this meditative state. But specifically for why I wrote about snail endlings, and an endling is the last surviving member of a species, that was inspired by this really poignant article by Ed Young in The Atlantic. It's called The Last of Its Kind. And it's all about, this effort to bring snails back from the brink of extinction. And it's a really tricky thing, but it's a very valuable thing.
Endling is such a lovely word. I love that word, endling, and I love that it names this book. And I love that this idea came from an article in The Atlantic, this idea about the last one of its species. But so tell me about Yeva. In the first part of the book, we meet Yeva. Tell us about her. I mean, I'm thinking about how it is that she is the, you know, the snail scientist and how that interest grew for you. But tell us about her.
Well, Yeva's a... she's a character of many layers, let's say. So we first meet her in the book as someone who's taking part in romance tours. And I'm not sure if you had heard of romance tours before this book, but it's this thing that used to happen where men from all over the world would come to Ukraine and other Eastern European countries to, you know, kind of sold on this promise that they would find the perfect docile bride in, you know, 10 days if they just went through this very packed itinerary of romantic activities. And, you know, of course, that's not realistic. I think there's this kind of perception of Eastern European women in the West that's quite not accurate. But anyway, so we meet Yeva, who is taking part in these romance tours, right, as a so-called, you know, prospective bride. And she's only doing it to fund her conservation research, right? She's trying to, breed these rare snails in her lab. And the ironic thing is that she's actually the least romantic character, maybe, that you will meet. And her family's telling her, you got to settle down, you got to stop with this mobile lab, whatever it is you're doing, you got to start a family. And she kind of sees herself as an endling because she doesn't want those things. She doesn't want children. And she kind of sees herself as the end of the line in a way. So, yeah, she's one of the characters who's grappling with this idea of, yeah, last of its kind. Mm-hmm.
I mean, the romance, these romance tours, this kind of bride industry, right? And how she fully engages in that. I mean, perhaps not fully in the sense of wholeheartedly. I mean, it is a means to an end for her. She's trying to raise money, but she does it for a long time. And it opens the way for some humor, I think, in the book. But also, I mean, this is deadly serious. This really did occur, this kind of business, this kind of industry. And maybe it still exists. I don't know. I know that there are dating apps also that are strictly for people who are looking for Ukrainian women. I have read about that. So it's just very interesting to me, this idea. But for her, she really kind of gets a bead on the types of men who would pay for these kinds of things, these services. And of course, it's fully against who she really, really is. As you say, she is like an endling. As she says, it's not that I like men or like women. I don't like either, she says. So she's just, you know, so interested in other things, not the least of which is just survival and survival for the snails. I want to talk a little bit about the different sections of the novel too. In that first section, we also meet Nastya and Solomia as part of this marriage industry. They have a very interesting story too. So I wonder if you can talk about them.
Yeah, Nastya and Solomia, so they too are taking part in this marriage industry, and they're doing it for their own reasons. They're doing it because they're trying to find their mother, who was an activist who disappeared. She was an activist who was fighting against this industry. And it's, kind of exploitative practices, right? And just as a side note, I do want to say, I think there's a general perception of, like, not just of Ukrainian women, but many other types of women abroad, that they're going to be somehow better than the local dating pool. So, like, for example, my sister had this conversation with an American man who told her, you know, like, American women are too aggressive and too ambitious, right? So there's this idea of, well, if you just go abroad, the women will somehow be more suitable. On that note of, you know, go back to Nastya and Solomia. So their mother was really trying to fight against this kind of commodification of women through this industry, and she disappears. And Nastya and Sol, they think, well, if we can pull a really big activism stunt, maybe she'll come back. You know, if she's out there hiding somewhere, she'll come back to us. So they conceive of this plan to kidnap 13 of these men who have come to Ukraine, these would-be grooms, to kidnap them, kind of to send a message about what this industry is really about. Yeah.
And in your research, did you talk to men and women in this kind of industry, this bride industry?
So my research, believe it or not, it consisted of reading a lot of self-published guidebooks about how to date Ukrainian women. Wow. And I mean, I was born in Ukraine. I left as a child, but, you know, my family's there, et cetera. So I identify myself as, like, part Ukrainian, part Canadian. And it was really strange to be kind of reading about my own people in these guidebooks for how to date Ukrainian women. And it's almost like I was learning so much about what people thought about us, you know? So that was my research, and that actually went into the novel, the kinds of stuff people would write. And it basically, yeah, it's about, you know, how as if feminism hasn't made it into Ukraine yet, which, of course, is very much not true. There's a very strong history of feminist activism there. Yeah.
That's so interesting. So you say a couple of things I want to ask you about. So anybody listening to this, you know, needs a scorecard. Like, we have the romance tours, we have the snail conservationists, the feminist activists, their mother, the protester. We have this kidnapping of these grooms, potential grooms, and more. And it all fits. It all makes sense. It, you know, we can follow it so clearly and so easily. But this idea that your real research, real things that happened to you, Maria Reva, end up in this book too, because then Russia invades Ukraine and there's a shift in the novel, this sort of metafictional thing, sort of shift that happens. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the second part of the book. It is such an interesting shift that occurs that has so many people talking. I'll say this. Mainly, I think, I mean, it is a bold move, but it's so successful from my vantage point, part of the composite whole of the novel. I mean, I think I can't imagine it any other way. Now that I've read it end to end, it's sort of like, yes, this makes perfect sense to me. It's this shift to these to this part, and then there's another part, and then there's a fourth part. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about your choice to do that. What was the conversation like with your, I don't know, with your agent or your editor or your publisher at the time when you made the decision to move into the second part?
Right. Well, first off, thank you for saying that. I really could not keep writing it any other way. So to backtrack a bit, so when Russia launched its full-scale invasion, I gave up on the novel. I couldn't keep writing it anymore, and I gave up on fiction altogether for a while. Just the reality of what was happening was so terrible. And my relatives were hearing explosions, calling us from Ukraine, and all but one would eventually have to flee their homes. So I was grappling with these questions of how do I keep writing this book if its setting is being destroyed in real time? And how do I keep living, you know, more broadly, how do I keep living my life when reality has split into two, right? One is the what's happening, these atrocities that are happening abroad. And the other piece is trying to keep living my life here in Canada. And, you know, it was this total disorientation and dislocation. And I think that's a feeling that a lot of us here grapple with in the current state of the world. And I realized that the only way I could keep writing my novel was to fold all these questions into it and insert myself into the pages of the novel as a character. So that's what that metafictional element is. It's kind of that breaking down of the fourth wall. So without giving too much away, I mean, it starts as a fiction. So it starts as a work of fiction, but it ends as nonfiction.
And it works. How do you feel about these very early reviews of your book and things said so far by people like Percival Everett and Margaret Atwood and Ann Patchett, Ben Fountain, and others? What does that do for you? What does that do?
It's quite surreal. I don't know if I've fully processed it yet, to be honest. When I was writing Endling, it was such a difficult process, and I really didn't think I could finish it. And then once I kind of saw the light in a way, and I saw the finish line, my entire goal was just to finish it. And it was a really intensive process. I'm pretty sure I gave myself a carpal tunnel. So I didn't envision a future really beyond just finishing this thing. And now that that future is here, I don't know. It's really, really wonderful. I just don't think it's sunk in yet.
Wow, but it's such high praise. I think it's well deserved. And you know, as we speak today, there's another round of peace talks between Ukraine and Russia, in Turkey. And despite these recent reports of these Russian attacks hitting Ukraine, after Kyiv hit Russia with drones, right? I'm just wondering, like, the timing of this is really interesting to me. I mean, it just happens when it's supposed to happen. But I wonder how closely you're following all of this news. You know, we live in a time. Yesterday, a man used a flamethrower in an attack on peaceful people, elderly people, one a Holocaust survivor in Colorado. What does your novel teach us? Your novel and your nonfiction. What does your book teach us about living through times like these? I mean, that's a terrible question. Just the idea that this book has to teach us something. But what has it brought to you in terms of thinking about how we live through times like these?
What I hope readers will take away from it, and of course I have no control over this, but I hope that they take away hope from the book. There are these moments in it where you think everything is lost, and yet there's a surprising place of hope and connection. Like, for example, the moment, there's a very dramatic moment when Yeva finds out that there's a possibility that one of her snail endlings will have a companion. However, that companion is right in the middle of the war zone. So when things are becoming really awful, sometimes life also gives you an opening, even if that opening is a really, really difficult one. So that's what I hope the reader will get from this, is that life is a very complex, multi-layered thing, and we never know what will happen.
Yeah, it's so funny. I have in my notes to ask you about the idea of hope. Readers of the book will find will happen upon what I'm about to ask you about. And I hope I'm not spoiling anything. Was there really a daytime talk show when you were 11 years old that convinced you of this power of the mind? And then you realize, you know what? I can't bend a spoon with a mere look. There are certain things that we have to acknowledge we cannot control in our lives. Big things, big, impossible, terrible things. And then you say, if what you put your mind to comes to me, it feeds a delusion. Does the mind have this power? Is it hope? And then, I know it sounds so corny to ask it this way, but does the mind have this power? And isn't it a factor in the writing life? Hope, or luck, or timing, or something? How does someone like you, who was born in Ukraine, who loves Ukraine, who's still rooted there in many ways, how do you perceive the idea that, okay, you can't use your mind powers to bend a spoon, but you can use your mind powers for something else?
Right. Well, to go back to your question of, was there really a talk show about bending spoons with your mind. So that was based on Maury Povich. And there was an episode, when I was about 11 years old, there was an episode about that. And I was convinced for a while that I had learned how to bend spoons with my mind. And so many years later, when the full-scale invasion launched, I think I was going through the stages of grief, right? And one of the stages is bargaining. And I kept playing and replaying these scenarios in my mind of how I would end the war, what I would do, as almost like this hand from above, right? These delusions. And I realized I was trying to do that in my fiction as well, because my grandfather became a character in my book. And I kept running through this fantasy over and over, the scene where I go to his door in Kherson, right? So that's the region that was, it's the city that was occupied by the Russians and then liberated by the Ukrainians and then flooded. And now it's being attacked relentlessly. But my grandfather stayed through all of it and he's still there. Yeah. So I had these scenes in my mind where I just kept showing up at his door and taking him away, right?
Yeah.
But at some point I had to accept that he was rooted there. He was not going to leave. And ultimately it was his, I don't know if you can use the word choice, but it was his decision. And I think part of the book, you know, eventually what I had to accept is that I have to live with this reality, and so many of us do as well.
Well, you have something of a connection to Texas. You got your MFA from the Michener Center for Writers at the University of Texas. How did you find Texas?
Oh wow, it's such a varied place. Some of the best people I've ever met were in Texas, honestly. And I spent my time in Austin, and I have such fond memories of Austin and, you know, Barton Springs and just the lush greenery, the really loud birds, and the really strong literary scene in that city, right? There's the Harry Ransom Center, where these writerly archives are stored. So you can go in as a member of the public and just look through these old manuscripts, right? And you can kind of dig through the brains of all these great, great writers. So I will never forget, what that has given me. Mm-hmm.
Maria Reva, thank you so much for talking to me today. I'm so happy to get a chance to talk to you about your book, Endling.
Thank you so much for having me.
Maria Reva is the author of Endling. This has been Book Public from Texas Public Radio. Write to us at bookpublic@tpr.org. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.